All right, buckaroos and buckaritos, it's a part of the show. We're now calling the good, the bad, and the ugly in American law and politics with attorney Mickey O'Brand, Michael O'Brand. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Really good to have you here. And we really appreciate you coming in live today, too, because I can look right at you.
Well, I can look at you, too.
I know.
And Tommy J.
Here's looking at you. Anyway, if you don't mind, I just want, folks want to know about you a little bit. And I know you're a little reluctant to, I'll brag, but you don't brag about yourself. But I'm going to ask you a few questions. Where did you grow up?
In Montreal, old Montreal.
And when is the first time you put on a pair of ice skates?
Oh, probably I was about 4 or 5 years old.
And you've been playing hockey ever since?
I have, yeah.
That's one of the loves.
Still playing in an old man's league.
And when's the last time you scored a goal?
About a week ago.
Oh, that was a proud night. All righty. And where did you grow up? I mean, you grew up in Montreal, but where did you go to college?
Well, I started at Cal in Berkeley and then ended up in Santa Barbara, which happened to be a little bit more fun.
God, I can't imagine.
And that's where I graduated, at UCSB.
UCSB grad. And where'd you go to law school?
Well, it used to be called Hastings, but they've recently changed the name because apparently Hastings was another one of those bad guys, and it's now University of California, College of Law at San Francisco.
Was he a bad guy in the sense that, well, he was an Indian killer, right?
I don't know if he... Yeah, I think he was. I'm not sure what his history was exactly, but I guess he was the one that put up the money to start Hastings, which was the original law school of the University of California.
Well, good on him for that.
Yeah, the family sued the state, try and keep the name, but they got shut out.
Did you get any honors when you were at Hastings Law School? Come on.
Another softball question.
I'm famous for it.
Yes, I did. We don't need to go into that, though.
Oh, come on. You were in the top 10. Can I brag?
Well, you've been bragging.
You were on Law Review. I read it. I saw it. That was how, part of our love story. Anyway, all right. You want to get right to the topics,
yeah,
don't you?
Yeah, let's talk about this case.
Okay. In the last days of the Supreme Court term, the court decided Arizona versus the Navajo Nation, an interesting case involving Native American history and water, two really important topics. Can you unpack that a little bit for us?
Sure, I'd love to. So some of you folks may know the Navajo tribe is one of the largest in the United States. It's got more than 300,000 members, around 170,000 or so live on the Navajo Reservation, which is huge. It's the geographically, it's the largest Native American reservation. It includes more than 17 million acres in the states of Arizona, New Mexico, and Utah. It's about the size of West Virginia. And it's almost entirely within the Colorado River Basin. Three vital rivers, the Colorado, the Big Colorado, the Little Colorado, and the San Juan, border the reservation. And yet, most of the homes in the reservation have no water.
No water with three rivers running through it.
Well, or around it. Yeah,
around
on
it.
The borders.
Okay, can you tell us a little of the history of the area?
Yeah, so anybody who's driven from Southern California to Southern Colorado may have driven through there. If you go out I-40, you get to Flagstaff, and then you go north toward Lake Powell, then you cut east on Highway 160, you'll go right through the Navajo Reservation, starting at Tuba City. In 1848, of course, the U.S. won the Mexican-American War and acquired all that territory from Mexico. And the Navajos lived in that area. And for the next couple of decades, the U.S. and the Navajo fought each other tooth and nail. In 1868, the U.S. and the Navajos finally agreed on a peace treaty, and the Navajos agreed not to make war anymore, and in return, they were given the right to use and occupy that reservation where they now live.
What were the Navajos asking for?
Well, in this case, the Navajos argued that, according to the majority opinion, and we'll get to this a little bit later, the dissent had a different view of what the Navajos were actually asking for. But according to Justice Kavanaugh, who wrote the majority opinion, the Navajos were asking that the United States take affirmative steps to secure water for the tribe, for example, by assessing the tribe's water needs and developing a plan to secure the needed water, potentially building pipelines, pumps, wells, or other water infrastructure. Now, over the decades, the federal government has taken various steps to help people in the western states with their water needs. In fact, for the Navajos in particular, the government has secured hundreds of thousands of acres of acre feet of water and authorized billions of dollars for water infrastructure on the Navajo reservation. I mean, driving through there, you'd never know that because it looks like one of the most arid, driest places on earth. But according to Kavanaugh, in the Navajos' views, these efforts did not fully satisfy the United States' obligations under the 1868 treaty, and therefore they sued the U.S. Department of Interior and other federal agencies. They asserted a breach of trust claim arising out of the 1868 treaty. The states of Arizona, Colorado, and Nevada also jumped into the case to protect their water rights.
And what was the court's ruling?
Well, as I said, this was an opinion written by Justice Kavanaugh. It was joined in by the other conservative justices, Thomas, Barrett, Alito, and Roberts. Justice Gorsuch, who normally votes with the conservatives, this time voted with the minority liberals. But in any event, the majority opinion said, although the 1868 treaty gave the Navajos the right to use and occupy this area, the treaty itself contained no language imposing a duty on the U.S. to provide them with water. Kind of typical of what the U.S. has done to the Native Americans over the years. It's like, okay, you can live here. You can use it all you want. You just don't get any water.
What about reparations? I know this isn't part of the question here, but I'm kind of in shock, and I know all our listeners are too.
Well, yeah, and you know, the court acknowledged that under their reserved water rights doctrine, the federal government's reservation of land for an Indian tribe also implicitly reserves the right to use needed water from groundwater, rivers, streams, lakes, springs that arise on, border, cross, underline, or encompassed within the reservation. But that was the opinion of the court.
Now, I'm going to ask you, what was there a dissent? And first, you have a request for a song, and I think it's perfect.
Yeah, before we get to the descent, which was kind of interesting, I have a request to play Geronimo's Cadillac by Hoyt Axton.
Well, here you go. Right here on KXFM, this is Michael Obrand with the good, the bad, and the ugly in American politics and law. And here's his request, Geronimo's Cadillac.
Sergeant, can't you feel something's wrong with your automobile? Warden, warden, listen to me. Be brave and set Geronimo free. Governor, governor, isn't it strange? You never see a car on the Indian range.
And that was Hoyt Axton from his Life Machine album, Geronimo's Cadillac. And sitting in with me right now is Michael Obrand, the good, the bad, featuring the good, the bad, and the ugly in American politics and law. So let's get back to the subject. We're talking about the Navajo water rights case with the Supreme Court. And let's get back to, was there a dissent?
Yes, there was. And interestingly, it was Judge Gorsuch who wrote the dissent for that was joined by the other liberal justices, Sotomayor, Kagan, and who's the other one? Anyway, he had a different history and a different view of what the Navajos were actually asking for. In his view, the Navajo complaint was simply to compel the federal government to determine the water required to fulfill the promise made to them under the Treaty of 1868. He pointed out that although the reservation is adjacent to the Colorado River, the Navajo Nation's rights to use water from the Colorado River have never been adjudicated. And he also pointed out that the U.S. acknowledges that it holds certain water rights in trust for the Navajo. But instead of resolving what the Navajo's water rights might be, the U.S. has sometimes, in fact, generally resisted efforts to answer that question. Gorsuch got into the history of the Navajo and the land. He pointed out that they've occupied that land for centuries, that the ancestral home of the Navajo is framed by four mountains and four rivers the tribes considered sacred. But in the 1860s, their way of life, as it did for a lot of Native Americans, changed forever. There was, after the Mexican-American War, there was rapid expansion westward, and the U.S. found itself embroiled in a series of bitter conflicts with the Navajo. And the goal of the federal government was to really remove the tribe from that area and gain it for civilization for the U.S. And to that end, the government unleashed what has been described as a maelstrom of destruction on the tribe. And before all was said and done, the Navajo had to be literally starved into surrender. And thousands of U.S. troops roamed the Navajo country, destroying everything the Navajo can use. Every field, every storehouse and hut was burned. This campaign was brief, blunt, and combined with a particularly difficult winter, it was very effective. So Gorsuch said, with a view of this history, what the court should have done is at least order that the federal government at least assess and figure out what are the Navajo's water rights, which remain unknown until this day. And he said, what is known is that the U.S. holds some of the tribe's water rights in trust. But as he pointed out, those have never been determined. And at the end, he came up with kind of a classic line. He said, well, where do the Navajos go from here? To date, their efforts to find out what water rights the United States holds for them have produced an experience familiar to any American who has spent time at the Department of Water or the Department of Motor Vehicles. He said, like many of us who've done that, he said, the Navajos have waited in a long, long line, waited till they got up to the front, only to be told that they have been standing in the wrong line and they must try another. So that's where we are today, folks.
Gosh, nothing's changed in hundreds of years. What can they do now?
Well, I guess they can go back, and in some of these cases, what's going on now, there's, of course, we've had a very wet winter, which has kind of alleviated the situation, but there have been negotiations and an agreement among the various states that use the Colorado River water to reallocate the use of that river. Now, the Navajos can jump in to that or try to jump into that. They've been rebuffed before, but they can jump into that and try and get a piece of that Colorado River water for themselves.
Let's hope.
Let's do.
Thank you so much for coming in, Mickey O'Brand.
You're welcome. Good to be here.
Oh, it's great.
Love your show.
Well, we love having you here. You're making us a little more sophisticated, educated, and we're just happy you're on board, as always. So I'm going to do, instead of The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, I found Peter Rowan's The Land of the Navajo. How's that?
That's great.
Good pick, huh? All righty. See you next week.
Okay.
Same time, same place. This is Ida Mae and Tommy J bringing you the very best of Radio Neighboring on Wednesday mornings.
Oh, the wind blows cold on the trail of the buffalo. Oh, the wind blows cold in the land of the Navajo. In the land of the Navajo. Well, 100 miles from nowhere, out on the desert sand, One-Eyed Jack the trader held some turquoise in his hand. By his side sat Running Elk, his longtime Indian friend. He vowed that he would stay by Jack until the bitter end. Jack had gambled everything he owned to lead this wandering life. He might have had a happy home or a tender loving wife. But his hunger was for trading trappers' furs for turquoise stone. Anything that the Indians had, Jack wanted for his own. Oh, the wind blows cold on the trail of the buffalo. In the land of the Navajo. In the land of the Navajo. I said, Jack, to Running Elk, I'll gamble all my precious stones before I leave my body here among these bleaching bones. For now my time is drawing near and I'm filled with dark regret. My spirit longs to journey as the sun begins to set. But we raped and killed, we stole your land, we ruled with guns and knives, fed whiskey to your warriors while we stole away your wives. Said a Running Elk, what's done is done, you white men rule this land. So lay the cards face up and play your last broken-hearted hand. On the trail of the buffalo. Oh, the wind blows cold in the land of the Navajo. In the land of the Navajo. When you're dealing cards with death, the joker's wild, the ace is high. Jack bet the Mississippi River, Running Elk raised him the sky. Jack saw him with the sun and moon and upped him with the stars. Running Elk bet the Rocky Mountains, Jupiter and Mars. Well, the sun was sinking in the west when Jack drew the ace of spades. Running Elk just rolled his eyes, his smile, and passed away. Jack picked up his turquoise stones and cast them to the sky. He stared into the setting sun and he made a mournful cry. Oh, the wind blows cold on the trail of the buffalo. Oh, the wind blows cold in the land of the Navajo. In the land of the Navajo.